Welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, July 31st, 2022. I'm your reader, Sharon Faldo. From the front page of today's Gazette, majority of Iowans who regained rights voted in 2020. 3 years later, no legislative action on Reynolds' priority, by Aaron Murphy, Gazette Des Moines Bureau. It had been roughly two decades since he was allowed to vote, and Eric Harris felt it was important that he cast a ballot again. The Iowa City man, now in his 40s, lost his right to vote in Iowa when he was convicted of three felony offenses between 1998 and 2014. He regained it in 2020 when Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds issued an executive order that automatically reinstated the right to vote of Iowans such as Harris, who had been convicted of felonies but completed their sentences. So Harris, his rights restored, voted in the 2020 election. I spent almost 20 years not being able to vote because of felony convictions, Harris said. I just wanted to vote, and I was able to vote, and it was an important vote. The 2020 vote was a very important vote. Before Reynolds' executive order, Iowans who had been convicted of felonies were required to individually petition the governor to restore their voting rights. At the time, Iowa was the only state with a requirement that restrictive. After Reynolds issued her executive order, 3,955 Iowans who had previously been made ineligible to vote because of felony convictions re-registered to vote before that year's November election, according to data from the state elections office. Of those 3,955 newly registered voters, 3,041, which is 77%, or nearly 4 out of every 5 who re-registered, followed through and voted in the 2020 general election, according to the state data. The state data covers only those Iowans who had the right to vote, lost it upon conviction, and then re-registered to vote, after having that right restored by Reynolds' executive order. A spokesman said the state elections office does not have broader data on how many Iowans became eligible to vote with the executive order, even if they had not registered before, constraining the ability to determine what percentage of all Iowans who became newly eligible to register under the executive order. Various reports in 2020, including one from the issue advocacy group The Sentencing Project, estimated Reynolds' executive order has restored the voting rights of 35,000 to 45,000 Iowans. Harris believes so strongly that Iowans convicted of felonies should have the right to vote and should exercise that right that he has spent the past 3+ years encouraging others to register and vote. People right now, with things that's going on in the country right now, people might not be happy, Harris said, but when I was able to vote in 2020, that was important to me. When Reynolds issued the executive order, she called it a matter of second chances and acknowledging inequalities in the justice system. The right to vote is the cornerstone of society and the free republic in which we live. When someone serves their sentence, they should have their right to vote restored automatically, Reynolds said in a statement accompanying her executive order. The journey to that executive order, however, started on a different path. Reynolds originally called for state lawmakers to propose an amendment to the Iowa Constitution that would state that Iowans convicted of a felony would regain the right to vote upon completion of their sentences. Reynolds favored the constitutional amendment because it is a more permanent solution. Executive orders, in contrast, can be undone by the next governor. That's exactly what has happened with the issue of voting rights for Iowans convicted of felonies. Governor Tom Vilsack in 2005 issued an executive order automatically reinstating the voting rights of Iowans who have completed their sentences for felony convictions. But in 2011, Republican Governor Terry Branstad issued his own executive order, which required Iowans who have completed their sentences for felony convictions to individually petition the governor to have their voting rights restored. But while a constitutional amendment was Reynolds' preferred path, proposals bogged down in the Iowa legislature, which is controlled by her fellow Republicans. In particular, Republicans in the Iowa Senate could not agree on what requirements should be added before a convicted voter had his or her rights restored. After failed attempts in the 2019 and 2020 legislative sessions, Reynolds resorted to the executive order just before the 2020 general election. Reynolds said at the time that she would continue to advocate for a constitutional amendment, but the issue received little to no discussion from majority agenda-setting Republicans in the 2021 or 2022 legislative sessions. Republican State House leaders said Reynolds' executive order removed the urgency from the issue. Harris said he believes the state could do more to inform and educate those Iowans about their restored voting rights, especially by meeting those Iowans where they are at community events. The bottom line for Harris, and why he also supports a more permanent solution, is that voting rights should be automatically granted to those who have completed their sentences. He said that right should not be left to the whims of only the governor. If, Harris said, you live in this country and pay taxes and you paid your debt to society, you should be able to vote. That's it. Also, from the front page of today's Gazette, faster completion of Tower Terrace rides on $25 million grant by Gage Miskimen of the Gazette. Hiawatha City Manager Kim Downs said she feels the stars are aligned for federal funding to come through this year to help, finally, complete the Hopscotch Tower Terrace Road. In August, the Cedar Rapids metro communities will find out whether they'll receive $25 million in U.S. Department of Transportation RAISE grant funding for the massive infrastructure project. The selection will be announced no later than August 12th. Hiawatha, along with Cedar Rapids, Marion, Robbins, Linn County, and the Iowa Department of Transportation, started earnestly in 2010 to plan for the project, which aims to connect a four-lane road from Interstate 380 to Highway 13, though the project has been an idea as far back as the 1960s. Local leaders say completing the 8.3-mile Tower Terrace Road, which now has gaps in it, would alleviate some of the congestion along other east-west corridors on the north side of the metro. That includes Boyson Road and Blair's Ferry Road, which see heavy traffic during daily commutes. In 2010, the Corridor Management Plan was adopted by the jurisdictions involved with the Metropolitan Planning Organization, which aimed to take the idea of a completed Tower Terrace and turn it into a reality. Corridor Metropolitan Planning Organization Manager Elizabeth Burke said the project has a benefit of $18 for every $1 invested by the year 2050, according to an analysis done as part of the RAISE grant application. It's based on the savings in travel time, crashes, property damage, serious injuries and fatalities, vehicle emissions, and delay at at-grade rail crossings, Burke said. The federal funding could make a drastic difference in the project's timeline. Right now, without the grant, the project is estimated to be completed in 2045. However, if the grant is awarded this year, the project could be finished in a decade. The RAISE program, formerly known as BUILD and TIGER, is a highly competitive U.S. Department of Transportation grant. Of 9,700 applicants, only 680 projects will receive funding, with a maximum award being $25 million. Burke said the remaining cost for the project is about $51 million, with an overall price tag of about $90 million. Last year, the project was awarded $5 million in federal appropriations, which were earmarked as a community funding project by Republican U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson to help engineering work and right-of-way acquisition. Right now, each jurisdiction has $10 million to $20 million worth of projects remaining for Tower Terrace. Marion at $21 million, Hiawatha at $12.9 million, Cedar Rapids at $12.1 million, and Robbins at $10.2 million. The communities have applied for the grant twice before and have not received it. Instead, they receive feedback about the application and how to make it stronger. This time, the application includes over 100 letters of support from businesses, unions, and leaders in the community. Last year's included about 20. From the Iowa Today section, Solon, focus on encouraging growth while keeping small-town charm, by Isabella Zaluska of the Gazette. Even before Cheryl Maloney moved to Solon, she knew there was something magical about the city in northern Johnson County. Maloney, who has family in Cedar Rapids, moved from Chicago to Solon in October 2020. Less than a year later, she opened the Eat Shop Bakery in August 2021. There's bakeries in Iowa City and some in Cedar Rapids, but there was a huge need here, and we just had no idea what it was going to be like, Maloney said. It's just been phenomenal. The Eat Shop is located on Main Street, a two-lane street blending old and new with access to a variety of local businesses. Solon's Main Street is home to Big Grove Brewery, the Brass Fountain, sister-owned Good Vibes Cafe, and it hosts the annual Solon Beef Days. And there's even more to come. Solon is among the state's 10 fastest-growing cities, according to census data. With that growth come more businesses and housing, as well as long-term planning for schools, emergency services, and infrastructure needs. We're excited about the growth, but we're also cautious about how it happens. And none of us want to take away that small-town feeling, Mayor Steve Stang said. We're not chasing growth like we did 20 years ago. Now we're trying to control growth as best we can. Solon has grown 48% in the last decade, from 2,037 residents in 2010 to 3,018 in 2020. The decade before that, from 2000 to 2010, the population grew by 73%, from 1,177 to 2,037 residents. The average household size in Solon is 3 people, with the median household income at $83,897, according to state data. Center City Administrator Cami Rasmussen said among the reasons for the growth is Solon's location. Being close to Cedar Rapids, Iowa City, Coralville, and North Liberty is appealing for those who want to work in a city but live in a smaller town. Rasmussen added that individuals who grew up in Solon often return to raise their families. Solon's city motto is, "A place to put down roots." "We have a lot of people who are returning to the community that were raised here and want that same experience for their families," Rasmussen said. "Then we have other families who are moving to the community, who are looking for that home away from home." The city's growth is top of mind for city staff and the 6-member Solon City Council. Rasmussen has been involved in Solon City government for almost 25 years. She was the city clerk and served on the city council and as mayor before stepping into the city administrator position. Stang, a lifelong Solon resident, has been on the council since 2006 and mayor since 2014. "I think that's the value that both Cami and I bring to the table, not only being on the council but being here a long time, is we know what works, we know what didn't work," Stang said. Rasmussen said elected officials do not want to place the burden of growth on the existing residents. Instead, the cost of sewer plant upgrades, new streets, new wells, and other infrastructure needs is funded by new growth and developers. Both Rasmussen and Stang credited Solon schools for playing a role in attracting families. The Solon Community School District has about 1,500 students, with a steady growth of 20 to 40 students each year. The school district anticipated the potential for accelerated growth and took steps in 2015 to plan, revising its open enrollment policy to more accurately predict that growth. In 2017, the board completed a 15-year facilities plan by building a new intermediate elementary school. The cost of housing nationwide has increased, including in Solon. The typical value of a home in Solon is $410,147, which has increased 18% over the past year, according to Zillow. The increased cost and the need to keep housing affordable is on the city's mind as the growth continues, Stang said. "The thought was, when I got on the council, that growth was going to have people that lived in these older homes move to newer homes and then open the older homes up for new couples to come in. But the problem is that older homes aren't that far in price from new homes anymore," Stang said. With those concerns in mind, the Watts Group is building nearly 300 units on the northwest side. They take into consideration residents' different price points and stages of life, from just out of college to starting a family to retiring, said Adam Hahn, director of construction with Watts Group. And the city is anticipating finishing its new fire station in the coming weeks. Ground was broken last September on the $4.2 million firehouse, which is funded by public donations, general obligation bonds, and local option sales tax revenue. And what's next? Being able to drive down Main Street and see the city's evolution is something Rasmussen doesn't take for granted. "These are all people's dreams, and they're finding them here on Solon Main Street, whether it's a new building, whether it's a revitalization, or whether it's an existing business. Just a block off Main Street, the St. Mary's Catholic Church Auditorium, built in 1915, is being redeveloped to include commercial space, a boutique hotel, and loft apartments. A clothing boutique is expected to move into one of the commercial spaces, and the intention is to add more retail." Rasmussen said, "We have such a strong restaurant destination identity now that the opportunity for shopping and boutique, I think, is there. With all the new developments, it opens the door for the future and other dreams and ideas. We have a lot of people who are returning to the community that were raised here and want that same experience for their families." In NewsTrack, catching up on an earlier story, Coralville repeals panhandling ordinance, by Isabella Zaluska of the Gazette in Coralville. The Coralville City Council has repealed its panhandling ordinance and replaced it with a pedestrian safety ordinance. Earlier this year, the ACLU of Iowa urged Coralville and 3 other cities to repeal ordinances against panhandling, saying the measures violate free speech rights. The organization sent letters to the cities of Coralville, Davenport, Dubuque, and Bettendorf, saying their ordinances are both unconstitutional and ineffective. The basis for the letters is a 2015 U.S. Supreme Court decision that struck down content-based regulations of free speech. "Rather than criminalizing panhandling through these ordinances, cities can modify restrictions and infrastructure to optimize pedestrian and traffic safety while avoiding being prejudicial to those living in poverty or limiting free speech," said Shefali Arora, staff attorney for the ACLU of Iowa. What's happened since? The Coralville City Council last week unanimously voted to repeal the existing ordinance and replace it with a pedestrian safety ordinance. The ordinance prohibits pedestrians from standing, sitting, or staying on medians in areas with a speed limit of 30 miles per hour or greater, unless the median is paved and at least 10 feet wide. Pedestrians are also prohibited from standing on medians in business or school areas. Pedestrians still can use those medians to cross the street. During the new ordinance's first consideration, June 28th, City Attorney Kevin Olson said the ordinance is based on a similar one in Des Moines. Pedestrians have a 2% chance of death when hit by a car traveling 20 miles per hour. That jumps to 40% when the car is traveling 30 miles per hour, according to a study Olson cited. This ordinance is intended to make sure that we do not have those types of accidents, he said. Individuals who are standing in the median will be informed it is against city code, Olson said. He added no citations had been issued for violating the panhandling ordinance that is now repealed. The 29 medians and 11 roundabout islands where pedestrians are prohibited from standing are listed in the ordinance. And turning to the week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state under the heading In the News, Maquoketa Caves State Park reopens. Maquoketa Caves State Park reopened to the public Thursday, a week after three members of a Cedar Falls family were killed while camping. The suspected gunman, Anthony Sherwin, 23, of La Vista, Nebraska, was later found dead of what authorities said was a self-inflicted gunshot wound in a wooded area inside the park. Tyler and Sarah Schmidt, both 42, and their daughter Lula, 6, were killed in their tent, authorities say. Arlo Schmidt, the Schmidt's 9-year-old son, escaped the attack. The park's campground remains closed, and a temporary memorial will be located at the park's entrance, the Iowa Department of Natural Resources said. School resource officers. The Cedar Rapids School Board has declined an offer from the City of Cedar Rapids to fully fund two additional school resource officers to work at Cedar Rapids Middle Schools after the school board voted earlier this month to remove those officers. The city offered to have the officers be based at the Cedar Rapids Police Station rather than at McKinley Steam Academy and Wilson Middle Schools, a point of concern for the school board. The school resource officers will continue to be based at the high schools and Polk Alternative. North Liberty Hospital. The Iowa Board of Regents on Wednesday unanimously agreed to increase the budget for the University of Iowa Healthcare's new facility in North Liberty by 33%, bringing the total price tag to $525.6 million, the costliest new hospital in state history. The increase was the worst-case scenario, and UIHC officials hope to come in under that new total once contracts are signed. The increased costs, officials said, are tied to construction inflation, construction labor shortages, and increased prices and limited availability of materials. New justice. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds named David May, a judge on the Iowa Court of Appeals, to the Iowa Supreme Court on Wednesday. May became the fifth justice appointed by Reynolds, and his appointment means all seven justices on the court were appointed by Republicans. May replaces former Justice Brent Appel, who retired this year after reaching the state-mandated Supreme Court retirement age of 72. Appel was appointed to the court by former Democratic Governor Tom Vilsack in 2006. May has served on the Iowa Court of Appeals since 2019. He was a district judge from 2016 to 2019 and worked at a Des Moines law firm for 14 years before that. He was chosen from among three finalists for the position. Tuition going up. Iowa residents will be paying more to attend Iowa's three public universities this fall after the Board of Regents on Wednesday approved a 4.25% tuition increase. At the University of Northern Iowa and Iowa State University, the rate hike applies to both resident and out-of-state students. At the University of Iowa, it will apply to in-state students, and out-of-state students will see their rates increased 1.2% for undergraduates and 1.5% for graduate students. Under the heading, They Said, at every point in this decision, Judge May at the Iowa Court of Appeals stood out for his experience, his approach to interpretation, and his commitment to judicial restraint. Governor Kim Reynolds on her appointment of David May to the Iowa Supreme Court. And my own view is that there is no excuse whatsoever for an insurrection and that we're in one of the most profound challenges to American democracy ever, excepting the Civil War. Jim Leach, former U.S. Representative for Eastern Iowa. Under the heading Odds and Ends, new pest. The invasive spotted lanternfly, which sports an expansive diet of plants, has made its first appearance in Iowa in Dallas County near Des Moines. The spotted lanternfly is native to China, India, and Vietnam. It uses a straw-like beak to suck sap out of plants and then excretes honeydew, a sugary substance where sooty mold can develop, capable of ruining people's outdoor experience, one state official said. Opioid lawsuits. Drug maker Teva agreed to contribute more than $4.2 billion in cash and medications to several states, including Iowa, in settling lawsuits that claim the company contributed to the opioid epidemic. Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller also announced Friday former opioid maker Allergan will pay up to $2.37 billion to Iowa and other states to settle lawsuits. Bus fares. Cedar Rapids Transit will begin charging $1 bus fare September 6th after using federal pandemic funds to offer free fares during the pandemic. The fares were $1.50 before the pandemic, and transit managers hope the lower fares will attract and keep riders. Under the heading Water Cooler, Deadly Amoeba in Iowa Lake, Iowa officials confirmed the presence of a brain-eating amoeba at the Lake of Three Fires State Park in southwest Iowa. The beach will be reopened with warnings about the presence of the amoeba. A Missouri resident was infected and later died of the parasitic infection last month. New COVID-19 cases up. COVID-19 cases in Iowa jumped 12% in the past week compared to the previous week. The state on Wednesday reported 5,924 new cases compared to 5,301 cases the week before. And under the heading More in the News, pilot shortage. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican Iowa, introduced a bill last week to raise the mandatory retirement age for pilots from 65 to 67, hoping to address pilot shortages that have caused flight cancellations across the country. Iowa airports said the measure would help, but it's not a silver bullet to solve widespread pilot and staffing shortages in the airline industry. Tobacco companies sued. Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller is suing more than a dozen tobacco companies, saying the companies withheld millions of dollars in settlement payments under false pretenses over the past two decades. The companies are required to pay money to states under a 1998 settlement, and they have withheld money every year since 2003, claiming that Iowa is not enforcing certain provisions of the settlement. Leach endorses two Democrats. Former Republican U.S. Representative Jim Leach, who represented Iowa for 30 years in Congress, has endorsed Democrats Christina Bohannon for the U.S. House and Mike Franken for the U.S. Senate. Leach, who teaches at the University of Iowa College of Law with Bohannon, said he switched his party registration from Republican to Democrat to vote in the June primary. He's not sure he'll stick with that, saying he's more interested in voting for candidates with decency. Leach has been critical of President Donald Trump and what he sees as a rightward lurch of the Republican Party. And suburbs as election battlegrounds. Iowa's suburbs and areas around the state's major cities are the battlegrounds for some of the more competitive statehouse races this November. Republicans are hoping to sway some suburban voters to vote for Republicans in legislative races by pushing concerns about inflation and school curriculum. Democrats are appealing to Iowans who want to see abortion kept legal and attacking Republicans on private school vouchers and school funding. Turning to the Insight page in Todd Dorman's 24-hour Dorman column, Norwood wants to transform agriculture. Democratic candidate for Iowa Secretary of Agriculture, John Norwood, has a lot of plans for transforming Iowa agriculture. A lot. You'll need to set aside a chunk of time to hear them. A flowchart might come in handy. But near the end of our roughly hour-long talk this past week, he summed up what needs to change succinctly. In Iowa, if you can't grow it on a million acres, it's not worth our time, Norwood said. We have that mindset, a commodity mindset. Norwood is challenging incumbent Republican Agriculture Secretary Mike Naig. Intensive row crop production of corn and beans is efficient and productive, Norwood said, but it's also causing problems. More land in fewer hands has contributed to rural population loss and dying small towns. It's led to massive soil erosion, poor soil health, and of course, dirty water. Scores of private wells are polluted. Outdoor recreation has been hampered. Norwood, a soil and water commissioner in Polk County, has seen one of the state's worst water quality sagas as toxins from algae blooms fed by cropland runoff have complicated delivering clean drinking water to the state's largest city and surrounding communities. In Des Moines, as you know, Sailorville Lake is a hypoxic zone. During some of the summer months, the water heats up, the algae starts blooming, Norwood said. The nutrients are the food, and when the toxins are produced, if you're walking around the lake with your dog, the dog drinks the water, the dog may die. And in Des Moines, the waterworks starts detecting the algae toxins and downstream, the Des Moines River being one of the two water intakes for surface water, and they have to turn it off because they don't have the treatment technology to take that out, Norwood said. some 750 impairments in over half our state waters. I don't know if we characterize that as a crisis, but it sounds like it's pretty darn close to a crisis, Norwood said. Iowa, Norwood argues, needs to embrace a more diverse selection of crops, such as adding a third or fourth crop to the traditional corn and beans rotation, to improve soil health and water quality. We can't just grow corn and beans from a resiliency standpoint because that doesn't build healthy soils, and healthy soils are critical to managing water quality. And healthy soils are critical to delivering healthy crops. They have higher nutrient density, Norwood said. Norwood met with a farmer near Osage who has adopted regenerative farming practices to build more organic matter in his fields. He estimates for every 1% increase in organic matter in the soil, his ground can hold an extra 27,000 gallons of water per acre. On 10 million acres of land, Norwood said that means holding back the water equivalent of 1.3 Sailorville lakes at flood stage. That's a lot of water, Norwood said. Diversifying crops means using resources that now mostly promote markets for corn and beans to creating markets for other crops, including food crops. He champions the idea of creating farm parks, sort of like industrial parks, that could serve as incubators for crop diversity that would give new farmers access to land that they normally can't afford. We're so busy, we tell ourselves, feeding the world, we can't even feed ourselves in this state. And I see that's where part of the economic development opportunity is aligning our farms, what we can grow and produce here in Iowa that's high quality, that's fresh, that's local, that's nutrient dense, and figuring out those markets. Editorial fellow Althea Cole writes, presidents don't control gas prices, but do influence them. On July 21st, drivers of over 230 cars got to fill their gas tanks in Hiawatha for $2.38 a gallon. I was on vacation and didn't get to be one of them, so I was a bit jealous. Like many Iowans, I'm feeling the proverbial pain at the pump. Filling up my Nissan used to run me somewhere around $28 if I really squeezed in every last drop. Just a few weeks ago, it cost me over $50, and that was using a 20-cent fuel saver discount. How did 230 drivers get to pay only $2.38 per gallon for gas when local prices were still hovering near $4? A political advocacy group that I volunteer for, called Americans for Prosperity, partnered with a local gas station to offer it for that amount for 2 hours as part of their True Cost initiative. $2.38 was the national average for a gallon of gasoline on the day President Joe Biden took office. The project was designed to bring attention to the failed policies of President Biden's administration, which they've summed up in four words: pay more, get less. That's what inflation is, paying more for the product, getting less out of the dollar. Gasoline is but one of the products and services for which Americans are paying more. According to Forbes, the aggregate price of meat is up 11.7%. Fruits and vegetables are up 8.1%. Electricity is up 13.7%, even though generation capacity is declining in some areas. Some products have succumbed to shrinkflation, where products are selling for the same cost but coming in smaller packages. Cottonelle brand toilet paper went from 340 sheets a roll to 312. Party-size Fritos packages have shrunk from 18 ounces to 15.5. Domino's Pizza reduced its $7.99 chicken wing special from 10 wings to 8. Inflation sucks, but I'm not going to pretend that the current administration's policies are the sole driver of inflation any more than I would believe them the sole cure. The price of goods and services, inflated or not, is driven by several things. In addition to policy, the balance of supply and demand, the cost of production, and the unfolding of global events can all have an effect. The price of oil has seen both inflation and deflation in recent years. It's hard to picture it now, but in April of 2020, oil prices crashed after Russia rejected a deal with OPEC to harness production, and the market was flooded just as demand tanked due to worldwide COVID-19 shutdowns. At one point, the price of a barrel of oil went negative. Companies had to pay buyers to take it off their hands and store it. Super cheap gas prices were great for consumers, but the supposedly greedy oil companies lost a combined $76 billion and had to lay off scores of employees. But while political policy isn't the sole driver of inflation or deflation, it plays a crucial role. In 2020, part of the fix for the wildly unstable oil market was to cut production in order to avoid a complete crash. Those cuts came in the form of a deal negotiated by former President Donald Trump in what oil expert Dan Yergin called his biggest and most complex deal ever made, and acted as a factor in settling the market. The same influence wielded by President Trump to help still a spiraling market now rests in the hands of President Joe Biden. After denying responsibility only months earlier for the record soaring of gas prices nationwide, the president blamed everyone from Russian President Vladimir Putin to the owners of mom-and-pop gas stations, whose profit margins average only 15 cents on a gallon of gas. He seems more than happy to take credit for the welcome backslide that's occurred over the last several weeks, boasting in a video posted to Twitter on Tuesday about his administration's actions having played a large part. The jury's still out on that, but at least the president finally agrees that his policies can affect the price at the pump, a welcome departure from the Putin price hike rhetoric. Unfortunately, those policies, which include releasing millions of barrels of oil from the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve and auctioning some off to other countries, are thought to have little actual effect on gas prices. In fact, some of those policies stand to be the culprit for the high cost of energy, not the cure. Take canceling the Keystone XL pipeline on day one of Biden's presidency, for example, a move at which even environmentally woke Wonder Boy Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau expressed disappointment. The project was to transport up to 830,000 barrels of crude oil each day in an efficient and cost-effective manner. That loss for the U.S. and Canada is a win for Russia, which may be able to transport oil in vast quantities through its own pipeline soon. Should the completed Nord Stream 2 pipeline ever become operational, the Russians will have Biden to thank in part for his waiving of sanctions on the builder only weeks after he canceled the Keystone XL. Regulations put forth by the Biden administration don't exactly spell out a desire to bolster our participation in a healthy and thriving oil market either. Russian pipelines are apparently okay, but drilling on American soil is a hard no. After attempting to raise climate-related cost estimates for oil and gas leases was found in federal court to be unnecessarily harmful to energy-producing states, the administration suspended the plans for those leases altogether. America needs more oil, but President Biden seems determined to do the opposite. What else should we expect from a president who pledged on the campaign trail to get rid of fossil fuels? Gas prices have slid in the last month. That's a good thing, but it's hard to get excited when in most states the average cost still is double the national average from when President Biden took office. Turning to the community letters and the editorial cartoon, the editorial cartoon is from Jack Oman, a syndicated cartoonist distributed by Counterpoint Media. We have a caricature of former President Trump standing in front of a street sign reading January 6th Avenue, holding what appears to be a smoking gun with the body of something marked Democracy in the background in front of the Capitol, while a man in a sweatshirt with the United States flag with his arm around a woman with the word Garland written on her handbag, the man says, "Could you speed this up a bit?" The first letter today, Congress must take strong action on guns, from David L. Wolf of Cedar Rapids. I suggest all American buildings continually fly their flags at half staff until Congress passes a stronger bill on gun safety. That way, our U.S. representatives and U.S. senators will be regularly reminded of their responsibilities to keep American citizens safe. The tragedy in Highland Park, Illinois, has personally affected all members of my family. That event and the frequent mass shooting incidents throughout our country have impacted families from coast to coast. These horrific events are largely preventable if only our politicians would take serious action. It's way past the time to take military weapons of war off our streets. Congress must leave partisanship behind and get to work on this issue of life and death. David L. Wolf of Cedar Rapids. Pipeline meeting times leave out landowners, from Michael Daly of Lisbon. As a property owner in the path of the Wolf Carbon Solutions proposed hazardous liquid carbon pipeline, I am concerned about the schedule of meetings requested by Wolf and approved by the Iowa Utilities Board. The meetings for the most populated counties in the pipeline route, Johnson, Linn, and Scott counties, are scheduled at August 29th, August 30th, and August 31st at noon in the middle of a workday. Does the Iowa Utilities Board expect these meetings to be well attended? In Linn County alone, there are hundreds of property owners who may be affected. It is obvious that the majority of these landowners are employed during the day. Possibly both spouses in that household are working and thus won't be able to attend a noon meeting. The purpose of these meetings is to inform the involved property owners of the Wolf hazardous liquid pipeline intentions. Why not schedule the meetings when they can be well attended? The convenience of the property owner should be considered, not just the opportune schedule of the pipeline company and the Iowa Utilities Board. The importance of quality negotiations depend on good communication and the knowledge of details. The Iowa Utilities Board should at least try to ensure that both negotiating parties have an equal opportunity for discussion and a question-answer session. I have filed a formal objection to the Iowa Utilities Board on Wolf's hazardous liquid pipeline docket, HPL 2022-0002, and I encourage all other involved property owners to do the same. Michael Daly of Lisbon. The next letter from Scott Burnett of Cedar Rapids, proud to be part of the tolerant left. Sunday's letter from an enlightened MAGA reader seems to imply he knows what's on the mind of someone who doesn't think quite like himself. I lean to the left and I don't hate anyone, Mr. Patton. I just happen to believe that Donald Trump is a con man and a criminal and doesn't deserve to be in charge of anything. But Trump and Governor Ron DeSantis aren't the real problem with people like you. There is a sickness within the right-wing political culture, and Trump is just the symptom that comes from it. Left-wing people don't attack school board members or election workers for doing their job. They don't call teachers groomers, and they don't just send thoughts and prayers when another bunch of kids are killed in a school. They demand action. I'm happy to be labeled tolerant left. Scott Burnett of Cedar Rapids. The next letter, Peggy Kubsack of Mount Vernon, writes all humans valuable, including the unborn. In Monday's Gazette, a full page was devoted to try and convince us that a recent poll shows that 60% of Iowans think abortions should be legal in most or all cases. You can make any poll reflect your opinion by selecting the right people for your poll. Therefore, most polls are meaningless. The article includes opinions of four Iowans who coincidentally all disagree with the Supreme Court's decision that our Constitution doesn't recognize a right to an abortion. Specifics given from abortion rights supporters cite different reasons to keep abortion legal. One woman had an abortion for financial reasons. Another man said abortion is a right from conception until a heartbeat can be detected. After that, abortion is no different from killing a child. Another woman opposes abortion except for health reasons or whatever the doctor sees as necessary. Just like choosing your poll sample, you can probably find a doctor who would find abortion necessary. The last comment was from a man who said the government needs to stay clear the hell out of it and leave it up to the lady. Unfortunately, the unborn child cannot speak for or protect itself from any of these reasons. He or she relies on those of us who see every form of human being as valuable with the unalienable right to life. Don't let media propaganda tell you what is right or wrong. Speak up and vote for life. Peggy Kubsack of Mount Vernon. And finally, Stella Silver of Cedar Rapids writes praise for TCR's Mamma Mia. I recently attended Theater Cedar Rapids' production of Mamma Mia. What a fabulous show. This high-energy musical was flawless. The singing, dancing, costumes, sound, and scenery all meshed beautifully. The casting of the performers was perfect. Janelle Lauer was born to star in the leading role. Sophie Lindwall, who grew up performing on the TCR stage, has again shown her talent and poise in her role. As I occasionally glanced at the audience throughout the show, I could see that everyone was always smiling as well as keeping time to the beat and controlling the urge to get up and dance. TCR has done it again, nothing but the best. Congratulations, Stella Silver of Cedar Rapids. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, July 31st, 2022 on the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. I'm your reader, Sharon Falduto, and I apologize for the fact that I wasn't delivered a hard copy of the newspaper today, which means I'm reading the digital version, which is just a little bit trickier to navigate. And we turn now to today's obituaries. Kathy Braun Werning, age 96, of Newhall, passed away July 28th. Phillips Funeral Home of Vinton, handling arrangements. Arlene J. Boardman, age 93, of Cedar Rapids, went to be with her Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, on Wednesday, July 27th. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, August 4th, at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Funeral service will take place at 1 p.m. Friday, August 5th, at the Cedar Valley Bible Church. Interment will follow at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Arlene had a devout faith and a strong love for the Lord. She enjoyed gardening, traveling, fishing, crafting, attending family gatherings, and was known for being the best cookie baker there was. Archie L. Blackford, age 89, of Robbins, passed away on Thursday, July 28th, at Hallmark Care Center in Cedar Rapids. A private graveside service with full military honors will be held at Lafayette Cemetery in rural Alburnett. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. Archie served honorably in the U.S. Army from 1953 to 1955 during the Korean conflict. He worked as an assembly operator for Collins Radio for 37 years. Archie was an amateur radio operator for many years with the call sign KF0OP. He was a member of the Collins Amateur Radio Club and the Cedar Valley Amateur Radio Club. He enjoyed playing the mandolin and guitar for many years and loved bluegrass music. Laureen Lee Jansa of Cedar Rapids passed away on July 27th at the Unity Point Transitional Care Center. Visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. Saturday, August 6th, at First Lutheran Church in Cedar Rapids. The funeral will take place following visitation in the sanctuary from 11 to 11:45 a.m. Please join the family for a luncheon following the service in the Fellowship Hall on the lower level. The Reverend Craig Brown is officiating the service. Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center on Bowling Street is assisting the family. Private family interment will be at a later date. Lauren grew up to love hunting and fishing and following Iowa sporting events, especially football, basketball, and wrestling. He was a juvenile parole officer in the Mount Pleasant area and then in the Cedar Rapids district. After graduation, he became assistant director of the Linn County Department of Social Services, eventually becoming director and district assistant director. He later became the director of Council on Aging and director of Human Resources and Safety at various companies. Stephen Kenneth Bentz of Tucson, Arizona, known as Steve, age 82, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away March 1, 2022. A visitation will be held from 10 to 11:30 a.m. Saturday, August 6th, at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Steve served as president of the Iowa State Bowling Proprietors Association in 1983 to 84. In 1998, he was inducted into the Cedar Rapids Bowling Hall of Fame. Steve was a longtime contributor to the University of Iowa Athletic Department. Kevin John Schaffbutch of Cedar Rapids, born March 20, 1962, passed away in his sleep in his home on July 28, 2022. A private family service will be held at a later date. Mary L. Hahn, age 92 of Sigourney, died Tuesday, July 26th, at Unity Point Health Allen Memorial Hospital in Waterloo. Funeral Mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, August 3rd, at St. Mary Catholic Church in Sigourney, with Reverend Robert Lathrop officiating. Burial will be at St. Mary's Cemetery in Sigourney at a later date. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, August 2nd, at the Powell Funeral Home in Sigourney. Visitation will continue from 9:30 a.m. until service time at the church on Wednesday. Mary lived and farmed in the Hayesville community, and then when she finished raising their kids, she worked as a nurse at the Manor House Care Center. At age 56, retiring her nursing license at age 78. She was a member of St. Mary Catholic Church in Sigourney, the Altar and Rosary Society, the Farm Bureau Kitchen Band, and she was a 4-H leader. Mary was known for her peanut butter bars and spice bars and enjoyed sewing, gardening, canning, and holding her grandbabies and great-grandbabies. Alex Alfred Meyer of Jacksonville, Florida, age 91, passed away in his home in Jacksonville on Sunday, July 17th, and is now at home with the Lord. Alex served in the U.S. Navy during the Korean conflict. He began working for Amana Refrigeration. He was a born salesman and ultimately became chief executive officer of Amana Refrigeration, retiring as chairman of the board in 1997. His career was an example of leadership in both profit and nonprofit enterprises. In 1985, he was a recipient of the Oscar C. Schmidt Iowa Business Leadership Award. He served on many boards, including Merchants National Bank, Toro Company, Mercy Medical Center, the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art, and Westminster Presbyterian Church. A private graveside service will be held for family on August 2nd, with a reception to follow at 5 p.m. for family and friends. Dennis Von Assen of Newhall, a celebration of life for Dennis Saus Von Assen, who passed away November 24, 2020, at the age of 69. Pinky and family would like you to join them for an evening of memories and fellowship. Please bring a salad or finger food to share if you can. You can bring your own drinks and lawn chair. Meat will be provided as well as plates and tableware. Celebration of life from 5 to 9 p.m. Saturday, August 6th at Tracy Siemens Farm, 7123 25th Avenue in Newhall, Iowa. Anne Marie White, formerly of Marion, passed away suddenly July 23rd at the Rehabilitation Center of Lisbon. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, August 3rd at St. Joseph Catholic Church, 1790 14th Street in Marion. The visitation will be held prior to the service from 9:30 to 10:30, also at St. Joseph. Annie was born February 15th, 1969. She was a member of the St. Joseph Church of Marion and loved family gatherings, bingo, and dolphins. Anne always had a smile and loved her family, especially the littlest ones. John Montoya of Long Beach, California, passed on Tuesday, July 19th, 2022, at the young age of 91, with her family by her side at the hospital she volunteered at for 30 years, Long Beach Memorial Center. Joan was a bank teller at B of A in downtown Long Beach before entering into the aerospace industry as a secretary, retiring from Rockwell in 1996. If you knew her, you knew she preferred to remain busy and productive and chose to continue to work, being hired at Los Alamitos Racetrack as a Mutuel teller, retiring from there at the end of 2015. She enjoyed life, her family, friends, and her dogs to the fullest and has spent her final years as a huge Dodgers fan. A celebration of life will be planned in the future. Margaret Ann Randolph, born Margaret Ann Melly, age 95 of Anamosa, passed away on Thursday, July 7th at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, August 5th at St. Patrick's Catholic Church, with interment in the Holy Cross Cemetery. Friends may call 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday at the Getch Funeral Home, where a parish vigil service will be held at 6:30 p.m. Visitation will resume on Friday after 9 a.m. at the church. Monsignor James Miller and Deacon Mike Clapholtz will officiate the services. Getch Funeral Home has taken Margaret and her family into their care. Margaret loved family gatherings and visits from her children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. She also enjoyed bowling, knitting, bridge, and various card games and gardening. Margaret was an avid reader as well. And Arthur Green, known as John, of Cedar Rapids. On July 21st, John went to be with the Lord, surrounded by his family at Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy. John enjoyed fishing, hunting, and camping before his back injury. The family will hold a private celebration of life. Turning to the sports page, A7 Heaven, a look at the local area and Hawkeye players taken in the recent MLB draft by Jeff Johnson of the Gazette. Austin Krobe was asked via text the other day if he might have time for a quick interview. The Lisbon High School grad and former Kirkwood Community College TCU pitcher responded the following day, "I'll let you know when I have some free time, but as of now, we are pretty busy majority of the day," he politely texted. "Welcome to pro ball, Austin. The grind is real and it's constant." Krobe is less than a week into his career, working out with fellow recent San Diego Padres signees at the team's minor league complex in Peoria, Arizona. Those signees include former Iowa Hawkeye pitchers Adam Mazur and Dylan Nedved. Eventually, the trio will be assigned to one of the Padres' minor league affiliates, whether it's the rookie-level Arizona Complex League Padres in Peoria, low Class A Lake Elsinore of the California League, or high A Fort Wayne of the Midwest League. It's doubtful anyone will start higher than that. And here's where people are going. Adam Mazur from the Iowa Hawkeyes, San Diego Padres, bonuses were: the right-handed pitcher became a revelation after starring last summer in the prestigious College Cape Cod League, transferring from South Dakota State and becoming the Big Ten Conference's Pitcher of the Year. Iowa's highest-drafted player in 32 years, he went to the second round to San Diego, the 53rd overall pick. A mid-90s fastball is among a handful of pitches he throws. Signed with the Padres for $1.25 million, slightly below the slot value of $1,444,600. Dylan Nedved, Iowa, San Diego Padres. Nedved was a two-way player for Iowa until this season when he was strictly a pitcher. The right-hander went 6-2 with three saves and a 3.47 earned run average in 19 appearances. Essentially, he was drafted where he was, ninth round, so the Padres could save money to go above slot to sign other picks. His pick value was $161,500, and Nedved signed for $20,000. Austin Krobe, Lisbon, Kirkwood Community College, San Diego Padres. Spent 3 years at Texas Christian after 1 year at Kirkwood. Southpaw struck out 45 in 31 and a third innings this season in 13 appearances, six starts. Had a team-high 16 starts in 2021, striking out 96 in 85 innings. Signing bonus for the 12th rounder was $125,000, the maximum allowed under MLB rules for picks after the 10th round. Anything over $125,000 counts towards the team's assigned total bonus pool for the first 10 rounds. Penalties are assessed for teams that go over their bonus pools. Levi Usher, Cedar Rapids Prairie, Kirkwood Community College, Kansas City Royals. Spent one season at Kirkwood, was drafted in the 39th round by the Los Angeles Angels, but chose to attend Louisville instead, where he played three seasons, counting the 2020 COVID-shortened campaign. started 63 games in center field this season for the Cardinals, hitting .285 with 7 home runs. His defensive ability has been his calling card. Slot value for his 10th round pick was $153,600, and Usher signed for $72,500. Duncan Davitt, Iowa, Tampa Bay Rays. The right-hander from Indianola went 4-1 with a save and a 3.3 ERA in 19 appearances for the Hawkeyes this season. Struck out 61 in 40 innings and allowed just 30 hits. Tampa nabbed him in the 18th round and signed him for $25,000. Peyton Williams, Iowa, Toronto Blue Jays. The first baseman is a big man, listed 6'5" and 255 pounds, and can hit the ball as far as anyone. Also has a solid eye at the plate. Those skills got the Johnston native picked by Toronto in the 7th round. Hit .335 with 13 home runs in 54 games this past season as a redshirt sophomore. His signing bonus of $197,500 was just slightly below slot value of $210,500. And Tommy Specht of Dubuque-Wallert, Texas Rangers. Outfielder declined to play his high school season, instead focusing on the draft and playing with the Clinton Lumber Kings of the Collegiate Prospect League. Lefty swinger with prototypical size, 6'3", 200 pounds, was taken by Texas in the 6th round and signed an above-slot deal with a bonus of $450,000. Slot value was $314,400. Texas drafted another Wallert grad and catcher Ian Moeller in the 4th round, although Moeller never played one game of prep baseball, playing on traveling teams instead. He's playing for Down East, the Rangers' low Class A minor league affiliate. And turning to the History Happenings column that is written by college student Jessica Klein, who wins awards for historical research and presentation, and her dad, writer Rob Klein, who does not. They write this monthly column for the History Center. Cedar Rapids Seawall. Efforts to build flood protection led to legal fight in the early 1900s. Summers in Cedar Rapids are known for many things: the Freedom Festival, children's programs at the public library, corn humidity, and, among much else, Cedar Rapids Municipal Band concerts. It was while we were at a municipal band concert in Ellis Park and listening to the Cedar Rapids Song of Dedication that we found ourselves thinking about the river. For those unfamiliar with the lyrics of the Song of Dedication, which audiences first heard when the municipal band premiered it in October 1962, the 5th and 6th lines of the piece are, "Time and the river flow along, time and my life are like the river." Those particular lyrics stuck with us, given how the Cedar River was in view, flowing along. But as we all know too well, the Cedar River has a tendency to do a bit more than flow along, and that got us thinking about development along the river over the years. Our interest was further piqued by a recent History Center acquisition of printing blocks dating to 1908. The blocks were made by the Riverfront Improvement Commission to illustrate flood control plans along the Cedar River. Tara Templeman, the History Center's curator, was able to provide us with more information about the commission and its efforts to provide flood protection to the city, its businesses, and its residents. The first mention of the riverfront improvement is in 1901, Templeman told us. The issue was to be debated by the Commercial Club in November and seemed to focus mostly on whether or not the island, Mays Island that is, should be purchased. By 1908, an official commission was established to help define the channel of the river and keep the water from overflowing. $1,004 was spent on surveying and platting that year. The printing blocks are likely the result of that work. Several years later, construction of a seawall was under discussion, but the conversation was, ironically, complicated by the 1915 flood. The construction on the west side seemed to go fairly well, Templeman said, but business owners on the east side had more to say after the 1915 flood. In 1915, there was heavy rain, which caused the Cedar River to rise 5 feet, so high that all hope of completing the new dam and the riverfront improvement seawall has been abandoned, according to reports at the time. Property owners expressed grave concerns about the improvement plans because the proposed seawall and 15-foot sidewalks would impinge on their land. A contentious meeting was held in May 1916 and was announced on the front page of the Cedar Rapids Republican on May 10th with an overwrought, multi-layered headline. Mass meeting called on the riverfront proposition / rampant circular stirs interest in much discussed project / go and hear the truth / false and malicious statement alleged to have been made in circular and a warm time is anticipated. The project seemed doomed when in 1917 the city council passed an ordinance prohibiting the commission from spending any money, including hiring lawyers, without first getting approval from the council. The legal battle continued all the way to the Iowa Supreme Court in 1919, and the court ruled that the commission could proceed with construction. The ruling dealt a blow to the claims of property holders along the Cedar River. The ruling was that all the land on the 1849 map on the riverside of the high water mark was public land and did not belong to the business owners who had constructed buildings there, Templeman said. No title could be obtained by occupancy of the land, erection of buildings, or payment of taxes, no matter how long continued. This land could then be used in whatever way was necessary to prevent future flooding. By 1929, the legal battle was finally over and the decision was made to build a seawall. Of course, here in the present, work continues in the effort to ensure the Cedar River stays within its banks. Work that, like that of the Riverfront Improvement Commission, has sometimes seems to be fighting against a strong current. Nevertheless, we might argue that progress, like time in the river, does in fact flow along. And that brings me to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, July 31st, 2022. I have selected and lightly edited the articles that have been read. You can find a recording of this or any other IRIS content at any time on our website, iowaradioreading.org. I've been your reader, Sharon Falduto. Thank you for listening.